Hi, and welcome to episode 150 of the Sea Control Podcast. I'm your senior producer for Sea Control, Chris Lee, and this week, join us as we wrap up our interview with former Secretary of the Navy, John Dalton, and former First Lady of the Navy, Margaret Dalton. We'll get started with part two of this enlightening interview after a short message from our sponsors.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
All right. So the last question really is, you served as a leader for essentially your entire life. You started out as a naval officer. We've talked about your business career a little bit, where you were a leader in every organization you worked for, from Goldman Sachs up to your posts at the top of the banking industry and government. And then, of course, you became the Secretary of the Navy. And I'm just wondering what your advice would be to sailors and junior officers that want to serve their country in the same capacity that you have, or to the same degree that you have.
I was unsolicited when, shortly after I became secretary, I received the timeless traits of leadership that this minister had sent me from California, and I never had heard of him or knew him, but he and his staff did a retreat, and they came up with these eight traits of leadership, and I tried to do my best to live by those, and they are: a leader is trusted, a leader takes the initiative, a leader uses good judgment, a leader speaks with authority, a leader strengthens others, a leader is optimistic and enthusiastic, never compromises absolutes, and leads by example. And I think those traits of leadership were very helpful to me when I was in office. And in terms of my prior career, I think you can summarize those eight traits of leadership in another leadership style program is basically: know your stuff, be a person of character, and take care of your people. And I think if you do, you know, either those eight traits or doing or following the summarized version is very helpful, was very helpful to me. But I want to emphasize the fact, Travis, that I had some successes in business and in government, and I had some failures in business and government. And so, you know, I haven't had all, you know, everything's not pretty and rosy from the standpoint of, I mean, I had a business one time where I thought I was going to face bankruptcy, and I avoided it. But, I mean, there are ups and downs in business and in government, and the thing is, I tell midshipmen when I talk to them, and I tell interns when I talk to them, the three things that you have to rely on when things go badly, and they will go badly for all of us. You know, I've talked about having a lot of balls in the air. We're all busy, and we all have balls in the air, but three of those balls are crystal, and they're your family, your faith, and your friends. And I think relying on those kinds of things has been very helpful to me throughout my career, and are things that should be emphasized in nurturing all of those things.
So, Mrs. Dalton, if we could transition over to asking you some questions.
You may do that.
So, Mrs. Dalton, how did you find being the First Lady of the Navy?
I loved every minute of it. It was a great, great experience. We had a... It opened my eyes so much. I had not... we had not been married when my husband was in the Navy. He was in graduate school when we married. So it was my first experience to any kind of Navy life. And it was just... I loved every minute of it. I really did. There were some tough times. There were some really tough times that he had that I was, you know, I was there for. But he loved every minute that he was in that position. Every day was they could be hard days, but they were always good days. And he looked forward to going in every day. And that made me happy. That made me really happy.
So what kind of experiences do you feel like you had before you became the First Lady of the Navy that helped contribute to how well you were able to help the Navy once you became the First Lady of the Navy?
Well, I will have to say that people all my life have told me that I was a good listener, and people would come to me anytime they, you know, had issues, and they would come and talk to me, and every now and then Johnny would say to me, "Is your shingle, you know, did you have your shingle out today?" And so that was one thing that that was helpful to me, was that I was able to listen to what I was being told. And when he became secretary, I was asked what kind of secretary's wife I wanted to be, whether I wanted to be active or whether I just wanted to go do social things. And I said, no, I really wanted to be active. And so the quality of life issues and working with the wives and families became my bailiwick. And I have never had trouble talking to people. And I've all our married life, we've been in a lot of very social situations, and I've always felt comfortable. So I was never uncomfortable being in with new groups and visiting with new groups, and I think that helped prepare me. Just that having had those experiences in the past, and then just knowing that I being aware of what other people were telling me and listening and being able to respond or pass them on as they needed to be passed on.
All right. So, what caught your eye about quality of life issues in the first place that made you want to focus on quality of life?
Well, the first time we ever took a trip, we went to Hawaii. One of our first travels was to Hawaii, and the women picked me up, and Johnny went off to meet with sailors and go to ships, and I went to look at housing and schools and all the medical things. And the first thing they did was drive me around to see the housing. And the first place we went was to see the Air Force housing, which was just lovely. And I thought, oh, this is a great, great way. I'd never been to look at how people in the Navy lived. And then they said, now we want to show you the Navy housing. And I said, great. And I said, where? And they were telling me where it was. And I said, they said, wherever it was. And I said, well, is that near where that slum area was that we saw? And they said, that is the slum area.
Wow.
And I knew right away that was, you know, I said, that can't be. And we went to look at the houses, and I was just appalled. And I thought, I can't believe we have people living like this. Why would anybody want to be in the Navy? Why would anybody want to be married to somebody in the Navy if this is how you live? I mean, there were terrible termite problems. There were holes in roofs. There was one house that I will never forget. This house, they had added sort of a porch, or wasn't necessarily a porch. It was some additional thing, and there was a big space between the roof lines. And anytime it rained, which was every day, rain came right down, you know, in between those two rooms. I went, well, you can't live like that. And it was awful. It was just awful. And so I decided that was really the thing. I was always interested in the medical things, and when they had issues with medical things about how could they get such and such, and they were too far away from something, and the educational things were pretty well taken care of because the DOD schools were good, but the housing was a real issue, and so that sort of became my thing.
If I can interrupt on the housing thing, that when she went to see that Navy housing in Pearl Harbor, she did her thing and I did mine, and we came back and we were changing clothes for dinner, and I said, "How was your day?" And she started telling me about it and how bad it was, and literally teared up talking about just how bad Navy housing was. And she said, "You can't let sailors live like this." And I said, "Okay, Margaret, when I get back to Washington, we'll ask for a briefing on housing, and I want you to come." So we had this briefing, which was scheduled for 30 minutes, and it lasted about an hour and 20 minutes. And the civil servant who was leading the briefing said, "Mr. Secretary, thank you for asking for this briefing. I want you to know that I've never met a Secretary of the Navy before, and I've certainly never given a briefing, but I'm happy to tell you about Navy housing." And so she went on to talk about Navy housing. And I realized we had a big problem. I mean, you know, Margaret had told me about it, but I could see that it was a bigger problem than I thought. And we did some more homework on it, and I asked for a meeting with Bill Perry, Secretary Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time and a very outstanding leader. And I asked for a meeting with him, and I went in to see him, and it was just the two of us. I guess somebody had told me, our office, not to bring any staff, and he didn't have anybody else. So I laid it out for him, and I said, "You know, here's what the Air Force spends per capita. This is what the Army spends per capita. This is what the Navy spends per capita. And this is what the Marine Corps spends per capita." I said, "Mr. Secretary, retention is going to be a major problem if we don't correct this." And he said, you know, he asked a few questions, and we visited back and forth. And I wasn't there more than a half an hour. You know, I finished, and he got it. And he said, let me look over this, and I'll get back to you." Before the day ended, John Deutsch called me, who was the Deputy Secretary of Defense at the time, and said, "You have $100 million additional dollars to spend in the next two fiscal years, the remainder of what's left in this year and next year on Navy housing." And he said, "Do you want it all to go for Navy housing?" And I said, "Every penny."
And takes a squeaky wheel.
It's amazing how you can affect so much change by listening and noticing what are clear problems to the people who are experiencing them, but would otherwise never be recognized.
The other thing too about that is that these women knew. I mean, they're not. I don't think their husbands would have liked it if they had gone and told the secretary. But they, because of their careers, but they didn't feel at all hesitant to tell me things, and I could tell my husband without giving any names. But I know if they had gone up person to person and said something, then you know, that would have been an issue for the husband, I'm sure. The husband would have perceived it as a big issue. But they could tell me things, and they told me a lot of things. I heard a lot in 5.5 years.
One question I was been curious about is, over the time that you all served as the Secretary of the First State of the Navy. There were quite a few scandals and tragic periods, to include the recovery from Tailhook. We talked a little bit about budgeting, but it had some real dramatic implications for the fleet. And then I think it was 1995, Admiral Borda took his own life tragically, and there were just a series of very public and sad experiences for the Navy family. And I'm curious how you felt, or how you responded to that, and how you were able to console and help recover the Navy in that time.
Well, I do think that that people were really affected by that, and I think I didn't hear as much as I thought I would have heard when we would travel about that. I heard more around here about it than I did, and I think
around here in D.C.
I think that probably an awful lot of the people around here knew Admiral Borda, the wives, and you know, not the of course the officers and the enlisted, but the wives, many of them knew Admiral Borda, and so it was a personal thing for an awful lot of the people around here. And I think that you know, you deal with that the way you deal with the death of any friend or any associate. I think probably you had a lot more backlash.
Well, I recommended to the Secretary of Defense, after interviewing four or five or six, I don't remember how many people I interviewed, to be the CNO. I mean, they were all 3- and 4-star admirals. I don't think I interviewed anybody that was less than 3-star, but I interviewed a number of people and selected, or recommended to the Secretary of Defense that Admiral Borda be selected. And, you know, we had a big, we talked about the morale problem. I mean, Mike Borda was a people person, and he was the first enlisted sailor that made it to 4 stars, and I thought with the morale problem that we had, that he would be good for the Navy. And there were, there were those who disagreed with that. I think he was a good CNO. He has his faults like we all do. He had his faults like we all do, but, I remember, being with him the day before he committed suicide, and he was as happy and as full of life, and him, vintage Mike Borda the day before. As a matter of fact, you know, I have a budget that includes the Navy and Marine Corps, and there's always a tussle between the two services in terms of how the pie is going to be split. You know, only I have so many dollars for the Navy Department, and we've got to fund two services. But the CNO at Mike Borda and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, Chuck Krulak, asked for an appointment with me, and they came in to see me the day before the budget was for me to send it down to Bill Perry and his, you know, the comptroller for the Department of Defense. And they came in and did a high five in front of my desk, and they just said, "We've got a recommendation for you that we think we're both happy with, and we hope that you'll support it." I mean, you know, for them to give each other a high five in my presence was, I mean, they just wanted to show me that
I don't think a lot of Marines would believe that General Krulak was capable of giving high fives.
But he did. He did that day. And then, you know, the next day, in a meeting with three or four people, and typically if the CNO needs to see me or the commandant, his aide will come in to see my aide and say, I hate to interrupt the secretary, but my boss needs to see him right away. And that didn't happen. Chuck Krulak came there, you know, came busting. I mean, I can remember how the door opened. And he came in and he said, Admiral Mike Borden has been shot. And we are, he was at his home, and we have circumvented the Navy Yard with Marines, and nope, we're going to find the perpetrator. And, you know, obviously he committed suicide, and so I went immediately to the hospital, and, you know, we had a press conference and so forth, and I just said, you know, this is a terrible tragedy, and they asked me a lot of questions. I said, I really don't know any of the details at this point. And that point, it wasn't even confirmed there was a suicide, you know. But the next day, you know, and asking questions, I talked to Admiral Pease, who was CHINFO, and he said, I know that you had a meeting with Mike Borda that morning. Tell me about it. And he said, well, he said, we had to finish this other meeting. And then he said, you know, you have this meeting with the reporter this afternoon from Newsweek. And he said, Admiral Borda said, what does he want to talk about? And he said, he wants to talk about the medals. And he said, well, just tell him the truth. And then it was about lunchtime, and he said, I'm going home for lunch. And he took the keys to the car. Normally the driver, you know, would, he said, no, I don't want you to drive. I don't want you to drive me. I'm going to drive my car home. And so he drove his car home. And he had said he was going to go have lunch with his wife. Well, he knew his wife was not there. She was on some social function, so she wasn't there. And he went home and wrote two suicide notes, one to the Navy personnel and one to his family, and walked out in the front, in the side yard and killed himself. And, you know, it was a tragedy, and I'll tell you, I know that President Clinton went to Mike Borda's home, I believe it was that evening, and met with his wife and his children, and spent like an hour and a half visiting with them. I mean, and that was never reported, but I know that's the you know, the family members have told me that's what he did. And he really empathized with people and spent quality time with them, and when things like this happened. And it was a big blow to the Navy, you know, when this happened. It really was.
How did you all, as a team, go about getting the Navy back on track and making the leadership transition happen smoothly and recover from the emotional toll of that whole situation as an institution?
Well, you know, it was, you know, one step in front of the other. I mean, it was a tragedy, but, you know, we had a job to do, and my job was to name a new or recommend a new CNO, and And, you know, I talked to several people and recommended Jay Johnson and the Navy, you know, had a job to do and had to move on. I mean, it was a tragedy, and it was a wonderful service at the National Cathedral, and the president spoke, and I spoke, and I don't remember who else.
I don't know.
But anyway, you know, I talked about what a fine. I read the true gentleman that he was back in our Reef Points, and I said this depicts Mike Borda. You know, he was a gentleman, a true gentleman, and I also told the story about his, what a great ship handler we were. One time we were at sea and they did a man overboard drill, and you know, Mike Borda said, "I'll take the con." And so, wow. I mean, the CNO is the, you know, off to the deck, Connie Osser, for this man overboard drill, and he, you know,
Alan Richardson's a very capable submariner. I'm not sure I'd be mortified or enthused.
Well, and you know, he pulled that ship around, and I mean, you know, you could look over the side, and there was the life preserver, the lifeline, you know, the floating.
Overboard.
Yeah. I mean, it was, and Admiral Borda said, "Mr. Secretary, do you want to do what?" I said, "No, thank you." I mean, I knew where my skills were, and they weren't, the ship handling was, I mean, you know, to that level was, I couldn't compete with that.
That'd be fun to watch.
But that was, you know, that guy got a big laugh from the congregation when I said, "No, thank you." But anyway, the Navy and Marine Corps are resilient, and you know, they marched off and continued to march. I mean, they got the job done, and they knew they had a job to do, and it was an unfortunate incident, and it really was terrible tragedy. But
did you all, Mrs. Dalton, did you all see an emotional toll having an effect on leadership morale in D.C. at the time?
I did not. Yeah, I mean, I mean, it was sad, and people, mm-hmm. and it was a shock, and people talked about it, but I really don't. I don't remember that it was. You know, as he said, there was a job to be done, and I'm sure there was a lot of talk, but that's pretty much what it was. And we all, everybody tried to be supportive of Betty Borda. I was just saying one of the great things about Mike Borda was that the enlisted just loved him. I mean, he was so close to them.
And, he was a sailor. I mean, you know, he really was.
And that was one of his really great things. They all over the Navy, they all thought he was wonderful, and they were so proud that somebody who had started out as an enlisted had risen to that rank.
As the first person to have been prior enlisted and then become a four-star admiral, you alluded a little bit to controversy about that kind of ascension. I'm just curious how that played out and how that was taken into account in his selection as CNO.
Well, I like I said earlier, we had a morale problem, and you know, Mike Borda was the sailor, and you know, there wasn't much pushback when he was named. I mean, he got confirmed easily. I mean, he had been chief of naval personnel and been on the Hill a lot and had a lot of friends on the Hill, and so they were very supportive of his nomination.
He made friends very easily.
Yeah.
He was a real... he was a real easy person to like.
Yeah, he really was.
With three people in leadership or in Navy leadership at the time that had had people on the mind and had quality of life as a focus, the two of you and Admiral Borda, I'm curious, ma'am, how you found the quality of life issues to be taken by the fleet. If you found that people were, that sailors and sailors' families were receptive to the kinds of changes that you were making with housing and just a restored focus on people, or if that was kind of taken strangely. I'm just curious how it was received.
They were thrilled. They were thrilled. They were thrilled with the improvements that were being made. And, I mean, I have people to this day who come up and thank me. They really do.
And, well, I'll tell you what, I got an email from a three-star Army General, Mick Kicklighter, just in the last couple of days, and he said, please give my regards to Mrs. Dalton, the best First Lady of the Navy ever had. I mean, you know, I mean, this is an Army three-star who said that about her.
Well, I think that it became apparent that this was, that morale and quality of life and the families were high on his mind, and in addition to what their husbands were doing and that kind of thing. I think he, and they knew that I was there to speak up for them. And I'd pass on whatever I, you know, whatever I saw and whatever I heard. And it's amazing to me that people still will say something, you know, all these years later, and they're out, and I mean, their husbands are out, and they'll just say, oh, I remember X, Y, you know.
I mean, we left office in 98. I mean, that's been almost 20 years ago.
And I think it had been a long time since anybody had paid much attention to the family life. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think it had not been a priority.
Particularly in the Navy Department. I think Air Force and the Army, they had emphasized those issues more than we had.
Navy families are notoriously resilient and famously tough. I'm just curious if you found that in your listening to the families talk, if there was any kind of reluctance to bring up issues, or if...
Not to me. They tell me anything. I mean, I know if they told their husbands that they had told me these things, they might not be happy. But they would tell me anything. I'd go in and have these meetings. Every time we'd go someplace, I'd meet with a good-sized group of ladies, and they never held back. And I think they knew that I would pass it on. And that, you know, that I was genuinely concerned about it, because I really was. And as I said earlier, I had no prior knowledge of Navy family life at all. My father had been in the Army during the war, but, you know, he was long out before I was born, or he was out shortly after I was born. And so I never knew anything at all about military life, and certainly not about family life in the Navy. So this was my first experience with it, and it was a huge eye-opener.
How so? How was it an eye-opener?
Well, first of all, I thought that the deployments, I kept thinking, I can't imagine having my husband gone all the time, and then, you know, and I found that everybody just sort of rolled with it. They knew that was that part of their life, and I found, too, it was great that they all sort of knew each other. They'd been stationed with somebody someplace else, I said, well, how do you know? So I said, oh, we were together when we were in Iceland, or we were together in wherever it was, you know, and the family feeling within the Navy is just, and the Marine Corps, is phenomenal. It just really is. It's just, there's so much support, which I had no idea about. I mean, I didn't have a reason to know. And so I'd go, and everything I learned about any kind of Navy life or Marine Corps family life was new. And it was, for the most part, it was wonderful. And I never, and nobody seemed to complain. At that time, as he said, they had 6-month deployments, and it was a pretty regular thing. And you knew your husband was going to be gone for 6 months, then he'd be home. And the one thing that I did hear was that when they were coming home, the wives said, we're used to being in charge of everything, and the husbands come back in and decide they should be in charge. And that part of it was always sort of a hard, you know, a breaking in point for them. But for the most part, they knew that. Now it's very different. And with as you all were talking about the drawdown a while ago, now it's very different, and you don't, you know, you, the times, the Navy is so small now that, and we're so, you know, spread so thin, you have to be all things to all people and be all places for anybody who, you know, anything, whether it's a conflict or whether a potential conflict or it's a tsunami or it's an earthquake or whatever, we're there. So, you know, the active duty person is gone. And a lot, and they, you know, they come in, and then just because they're back home doesn't mean they're really home, because they're training for the next deployment, or they're out doing something else, that so they're not necessarily home. And I applaud the recommendation to increase the size of the Navy and Marine Corps, because I think it's very difficult for families now.
You really get it.
Well. It's what I think. I mean, I just think it's got to be, and I think that and living conditions. I'm so pleased that the living conditions are so much better now. That's great, because I think that I can't imagine leaving for the 6 month deployment and leaving your family in these terrible conditions that they were 25 years ago. In a lot of places, not every place, but a lot of places. And being gone and knowing your family was in living like that. Now, if you know that they're in good, substantial, nice housing, have access to whatever they need, good medical care, good, you know, I think that's a good reason for having people stay in. I think there are a lot of enlisted people who now stay. They've got good housing, affordable housing, a good situation for schools. I think that helps with retention a lot, but the fact that we're so small and we have to be everywhere all the time, and we're just not enough of us to do that without being deployed an awful lot of the time, and that is a hindrance to retention.
For the Navy families that you've conversed with since you left the Department of the Navy, I'm curious if you hear the same discussion, the same, I don't want to say complaint, but the same criticism that the quality of life issues are sort of springing back up again because of the length of deployments and the production and maintenance.
I don't have a reason to hear that now. I'm the people who are on the, that I'm normally with are people who are in that sponsors group that I told you about, and they are far enough removed from that. Their husbands have been out for a long time, so I don't hear that so much anymore. But I do know the one thing that I do know is that they're not enough. We do need to build up the size of the Navy and the Marine Corps so that the active duty person is not gone all the time.
You really do just get it. It's incredible. I can't say I don't think any of our listeners are going to be surprised that you all get it, but it is refreshing.
I think something else too on that. I was talking to somebody and she said, you know, the veterans have been great in really working on wounded warriors and that kind of thing. But the veterans, particularly the ones who have not been out that long and who are pretty close to the situation, they could also be really out there beating the drums for increasing the size of the Navy and the Marine Corps, because they're right there. They've just left that or haven't been away too long.
Might even be the reason they left.
Very well could be. Could have been unhappy wives who never saw their husbands, or unhappy husbands who never saw their wives who were deployed.
So on a little bit of a lighter note, will you tell us about the sponsor program that you're involved in? And
oh, I will. I will indeed. I have the privilege of being the sponsor of the Seawolf submarine. And any woman who has that privilege of christening a ship and being the sponsor is invited to join the Society of Sponsors. And what that means is that you, anyone who has christened a ship can join this, and we're kind of it's a very unique group of people, and a sponsor of a ship, as just about everybody knows, anybody within the Navy or Marine Corps knows, is the one person who is with that ship forever. There are lots of different crews and lots of different captains and lots of different, you know, people on there, but there's only one sponsor, and it's really a special bond between not just the ship and the sponsor, but the other people who are sponsors who have had that experience. And it's a really good group of ladies, and it's a good thing to be a sponsor.
That seems pretty neat. I had the privilege of going to the commission of the USS Tulsa. It was the first time I ever had that opportunity, and seeing that whole ceremony and the seriousness with which our sponsor, Kathy Taylor, took it was just a really cool experience.
Well, have you ever been to a christening?
Sorry, that's what it was.
You went to the christening, not the commission. The christenings are... Well, I was president of the Society of Sponsors, and as president, I went to every ship that was... I was supposed to be. There were a couple that I couldn't go to that... the christening and the commissioning of every ship that was, you know, in that group during the 2 years that I was president of that organization, and there were a lot of them, and it was great. And it's you just, they make you feel so special, and you just think you're just, you know, queen for a day. It's a great experience.
That is really terrific. Well, Secretary Dalton, Mrs. Dalton, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with SIMSEC. Are there any last things you wanted to convey to our listeners?
No, I loved my service as Secretary of the Navy, and wouldn't take anything for the experience. And, you know, our sailors and Marines are special people, and they, you know, they get the job done. And I'm very proud of them and grateful to them for what they do. And wearing the cloth of our nation, so they're great people.
And I will say that people have asked me what the best thing about being the secretary's wife was, and there were lots. And we had the privilege of doing an awful lot of really wonderful things. But the best thing were the women, the wives, and the families that I had the opportunity to meet and to associate with during that time all over the world. They really are special women, and I applaud them for everything that they do.
Well, sir and ma'am, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for giving us this unique opportunity to get your perspective and your insight. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That concludes episode 150 for the Sea Control Podcast. I'm the senior producer for Sea Control, Chris Lee. Special thanks to former Secretary of the Navy, John Dalton, former First Lady of the Navy, Margaret Dalton, our own Executive Vice President at SIMSEC, Travis Nix, and this episode's Associate Producer, Danny Luo. If you like this episode but haven't yet subscribed, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to the newest content as it's released. If you really like this, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next time on Sea Control.